From the hills of central New York and the heart of the Finger Lakes, this is Frankly Speaking. I'm your host, Frank Rossi. My guest on this episode of Frankly Speaking is Dr. Michael Becken, a research scientist in the Division of Environment and Natural Resources at the Norwegian Institute of Bioeconomy Research. Michael has a bachelor's from William & Mary College, where he played golf, and a PhD from UW-Madison, where he worked with Professor Doug Soldat to quantify the efficiency of golf course resource use, and then became a Fulbright Scholar. In addition to his research in resource-efficient turfgrass systems, he studies carbon dynamics on Norwegian peatlands and is now exploring the study of carbon stocks on golf courses. As we consider resource use efficiency with Dr. Becken, it's important to understand that nutrient management is a critical aspect of overall golf course sustainability. Precision matters, and delivering those nutrients efficiently is exactly what the plant food company is all about. Plant food company's line of products are designed and tested to meet the nutrient needs of your plants without waste or loss to the environment, making them a sustainable choice. Contact your plant food rep or visit plantfoodco.com. Welcome to Frankly Speaking, Dr. Michael Becken. And, you know, we know each other quite a long time now. I remember meeting you at a GCSA conference and then following up down in D.C. when you came over. How long ago was that, if you can remind this old guy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was exactly 10 years ago now. It's 2025, and we met back in 2015, if I'm correct.
It goes by so fast. So listen, when I bumped into you back then, and we're going to talk a little bit about how you got to where you are, speaking to us live from Norway. When I met you back then, you were working with Jonathan Smith and the Golf Environment Organization, but I learned pretty quickly that you had an academic pedigree. So why don't you talk a little bit about your background? And up to 2015, what led you to you and I getting together back then?
Yeah, I grew up playing a ton of golf, always loved golf from the time I was, you know, I could walk basically. No one in my family plays golf. I just really gravitated to the game, watching it on TV. So that was always a love of mine. But then also, my parents are both geologists. So I was exposed to the earth sciences and quickly developed, like my parents, a love for the earth, sustainability, the environment. And so really those two interests, golf and the environment, came for me from an early age. And I thought, you know, why not put those two together in a career? Mm-hmm. And so that was my goal from childhood, really. So I went to college, played golf in college, majored in the environmental sciences, geology and biology, and then had my eyes set on the Golf Environment Organization working in Scotland, where the game started, you know, working for the NGO that Jonathan Smith still leads, helping golf courses try to become more sustainable. And at that point, when we met, I was in DC at an event that the GO was attending.
And you went to college, William & Mary?
That's right. Yeah, I grew up in Blacksburg, Virginia, where Virginia Tech is, and then went a little further east in Virginia to William & Mary in Williamsburg, and had a good experience there. Played on the golf team, majored in two sciences. Took me actually 5.5 years to get a double major and play 4 years of college golf, and then do a year abroad at University of St. Andrews, played on the golf team there too. So nice. I spent 5.5 years as an undergrad, but I tried to make the most of it.
Yeah, and you also, in that degree, have to submit an honors thesis of sorts as well.
That's right.
To get out of William & Mary. So listen, let's talk a little bit about, now you're in St. Andrews, you've got what would be, I think, in many cases, for what you described, a dream job, you know, home of golf, working on the environment, working in the sciences. And then somehow our paths crossed. Why don't we tell everybody what brought us together?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was working at GEO, I was in a position of seeing all of the information that comes into GEO. So golf courses around the world are applying for GEO certification, which is an eco label, like a fair trade stamp that you would see on a banana or chocolate or something. But let's say a golf course from Australia had applied for certification from GEO, they would give GEO information about water use, fertilizer use, pesticide use, other best management practices. And GEO would be in the position of having to make some judgment about whether or not this course was sustainable or eco-friendly. And I became really interested in scientific methods of trying to determine, you know, whether a golf course deserved certification under the GEO scheme. Mm-hmm. And how to try to make those methods as quantitative as possible. And so I started to look for people like yourself in the turfgrass world that had been, you know, thinking about those questions for a lot longer than I had.
And like me, you found there were few benchmarks, generally poor record keeping and understanding, right, of amounts and how they contribute to your overall sustainability. You were also working with courses around the world that were submitting them from lots of different climates as well. And I guess let me start with the simple question about the value of an eco-label, like Jonathan, Audubon International, the EPAR guys in Australia, and Kevin Fletcher here in the States. What's your general sense, having worked in that arena and viewing it? Because I obviously have been around since Audubon started, which was pre-GEO. What are your thoughts about the value of third-party review, sort of just in general?
I think they are valuable, but I think also it's really tough, especially in the world of golf, because if we're being realistic on the list of reasons why a golfer plays a specific golf course, you know, an eco label is going to be down the list inevitably. And that might be a little different when you're in the grocery store looking at a fair trade banana or not. But in golf, I think it's always going to be tough. And I think the other hard thing is that, you know, all of these programs are voluntary, right? And so people have to go over and above some of the regulatory requirements that they have to attain these eco labels. And that's a lot of extra work.
Yeah, there's no question about it. But what about the value to the course? Because I agree with everything you said. There's no demand for this. It's voluntary. Right. I'd go so far as to say in some cases, superintendents put themselves at risk if the club doesn't really care about this and conditioning is altered in any particular way. I always get a little bit nervous about that thing. So I'm in 100%. You nailed it. So for those souls that pioneer through to do it, what's the value to them from your perspective?
I think the value to them is a framework, if you will, of what sustainability is. So sustainability can mean so many different things, but I know the GEO program the best since I worked there for a couple of years, so I'll speak to that. The framework that they put together, I think, is compelling. So they talk about nature, resources, community, and now climate as well. And just having that sort of four-piece structure that you can organize your sustainability programs around, and then all of the subheadings, if you will, underneath each of those programs. So for nature, what are you doing for habitats and biodiversity on and around your course? Mm-hmm. Resources, how are you using water, fertilizer, energy, pesticides as efficiently as possible? Mm-hmm. Community, how are you bringing the community together? How are you creating a happy and healthy space on and around the golf course? And then climate, how are you contributing to trying to mitigate the climate crisis that we have going at the moment? So I think what it allows you to do is become more efficient, more organized, and learn what sustainability really means practically.
This is great. It's so important for us to really understand what sustainability means when we say it. We throw that word around a lot in the last 10, 20 years since financial things have happened and sort of environmental sustainability and carbon markets become more of our vernacular. All right, so let's go back to when you and I meet. I'm in the actual midst of working with Gil Hance and Jim Wagner building a hoopie down in this beautiful blown sand outside of Savannah. We connect. You want to go to graduate school. I'm like, hey, maybe we can get some funding out of this project. In the meantime, you're exploring other options. The stars aligned for you to go work with our former Cornell student, Doug Soldat, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So you came looking for better quantitative methods to basically do the job you would have been doing at GEO, right? Had this work been done when you were working at GEO, you might have never left GEO because a lot of these things, were in place. So talk a little bit about the transition out of St. Andrews into graduate school and formulating your questions and the things you wanted to work on with Doug.
Absolutely. When I was at GEO, as I said, we were receiving all of this information about water use and fertilizer use and pesticide use from golf courses all over the world. And I wanted to find ways of quantitatively determining whether or not a golf course in France, for example, that was applying water to their course, how efficient that was. And as you said, I looked out at the literature and there wasn't a whole lot there. And I thought, wow, you know, this is an opportunity for me. So I wrote a proposal and said an avenue that we could take is try to collect, you know, high quality resource use information, try to use ecosystem models mm-hmm. to model whether or not a golf course is using resources efficiently or not. So for example, with water, golf course tells us we're using this much water. Well, we can use a water balance model to do a computer simulation of the climate and the soils and the grass type. And then that gives us a certain amount of water that we think the golf course should roughly be using. And then we can compare that to what they're actually using and get some idea of efficiency. And then it's really interesting to think, once you have the initial definition of what efficiency is on a golf course, then you can start to think about why some golf courses might be more efficient than others. So let's say maybe maintenance budget plays a role, or maybe other economic factors have an influence on how efficiently a golf course is using resources. So you can just start to ask many interesting questions. In any case, I wrote all of this up in a proposal and I sent it to you and to Doug and a handful of other people. And it was only you and Doug responded. And so right away, I had two options.
So you embark upon this work and you did a lovely job of outlining sort of a couple of key things. You want to quantitatively determine things. You need really high quality data so you can model and then have some comparisons for what you quote unquote should be using versus what you are using, and then measure, have some benchmarks or quantitative measures of how you're doing with resource use in that particular case. So let's start with the nuts and bolts of this. How hard is it to get high quality data from the surveys that we had to do? And of course, I'm asking that question because I know, but I want everybody to understand the detailed nature of your data collection so they can understand what high quality data looks like or feels like.
It's extremely difficult, as of course you know, to get high quality survey data. And I completely understand why. When was the last time that you sat down at a survey and spent 2 or 3 hours doing it? You know, that's what we were asking golf course superintendents to do with our resource use survey that I ended up doing at Madison. The survey was hundreds of questions long. It asked really detailed information about water use, energy use, asked people to upload their entire pesticide records and fertilizer records for the last 3 years. As I said, all of their energy use, a lot of best management practices we asked about in the four main resource use categories, water, fertilizer, energy, and pesticide, because we were interested in how the uptake of best management practices might influence resource use efficiency. So we had so many questions that, you know, to answer all these questions, we had to ask a lot. And to be honest, I was blown away by the number of survey responses that we actually got. We got 144 in the end after 3 years of really hard work trying to get people to answer the survey. And you might say, well, 144, that's not much when you ask around the US and around Europe. But as I said at the start, when was the last time that you spent 3 to 5 hours answering a survey? And 144 superintendents did that for us. And I am, you know, eternally grateful.
Yeah. So now this is what I want everybody to understand. You get decent data, right? First, you're asking the right questions, right? We've sort of got to asking the right questions. Now you go out and you collect the data, you get really good data. And that data allows you now to model and predict and get some ideas of what kinds of numbers we're talking about. And really the elegance of this, and one of the things I think is so important, is you reached out, you know, outside of our traditional turf grass scientists, right, to a Chris Kasharik, who I believe is a modeler. Is this true?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about reaching out to Chris, working with modelers, using these various models to understand the world, because we can't get thousands of superintendents to fill out 2-3 hour surveys. So talk a little bit about the importance of getting engaged with a modeler like Chris.
Absolutely. The importance is you can ask a golf course and get really good information about resource use, but then you have to have, if they tell you how much water they use, then you have to have some benchmark or baseline to compare to. And really, I think the best way to do that is to run a simulation of that golf course in a computer and see what that golf course theoretically should be using as far as water is concerned. In any case, to do that, you have to reach out to the modeling community, which is a huge community of scientists that do sort all sorts of environmental modeling, from climate to soils to agriculture. Chris, in particular, is an agronomist or an agroecological modeler. So he's modeling agriculture as a whole, especially the environmental impacts of agriculture. So he runs a number of ecosystem models of various complexities. The most famous one that he runs is called Agro Ibis. It's about 20 years old. It simulates agricultural ecosystems, all sorts of environmental impacts, all sorts of inputs to the model. Yeah, it was incredibly important to get in touch with Chris. And what we were able to do with Chris was parameterize Agro Ibis for the Gulf environment. So we were able to basically take the grassland ecosystems that are already in Agro Ibis that simulate grass growth, soil development, nitrogen leaching, carbon emissions, carbon uptake. Any ecosystem process that you can think of is essentially simulated in this model, which is 10 to 15,000 lines of Fortran code.
Yeah.
And if you dive in there, you can, you know, write more code that allows you to simulate a golf course. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did.
Excellent. And so when we come back, we're going to get into the results of the variety of findings that came out of Michael's work in pesticides, nutrient use, water use. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. I'm with Michael Becken, a research scientist at the Norwegian Institute of Bioeconomy. We'll be right back. Efficient golf course operations rely on a functional and healthy soil. Dryject Services offers the right balance of water injection cultivation, but by injecting with sand and minimal disruption with maximum sand yield. If your soils need some amending and you could use a little less disruption, then Dryject Services are for you. Learn more about the tailored services Dryject can provide by contacting your Dryject rep or visiting dryject.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm with Michael Becken, a research scientist at the Norwegian Institute of Bioeconomy. And Michael, when we left, we were talking about the sort of elaborate work that you embarked upon and the data that you were able to collect. And now let's get into some of the findings. You know, there were other models that were used, one in particular, the EIQ, the environmental impact quotient that we've been using here at Cornell with my colleague, Carl Scimenti, who you know, and we've all published papers on a little bit. Let's start with the discussion about pesticide use. As you started to drill into each of these areas, like you were mentioning water earlier, let's talk about your drill into the pesticide use world. This tends to be a little bit dicey for people to talk about, that there's environmental impact, that we use the word risk associated with pesticide use, and people don't, you know, sometimes are uncomfortable with the idea of a risk associated with a pesticide. So why don't you give us the framework for your work and what some of the survey data was able to tell you about pesticide use in the U.S. and Europe.
Right. With pesticides, we actually didn't use Agro Ibis like I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. We're primarily using that for fertilizers and nutrient cycling and water cycling on mm-hmm. golf courses. With pesticides, we used a different class of ecosystem models, which are called pesticide risk indicator models. There are many different types of them. EIQ, or the environmental impact quotient, is one that was developed in New York by some of your colleagues, Frank. Another one is hazard quotient, which is a much simpler model, but has gained popularity in recent years for its simplicity, actually. But what all these different models have in common is that they measure pesticide risk based off of essentially two factors, and that is exposure, how much pesticide are you putting in the environment, and toxicity. How toxic is that pesticide to specifically non-target organisms? So, of course, you want the pesticide to be very toxic to what you're targeting, like a fungus, for example, but you want it to be non-toxic to what you're not targeting, like birds, fish, bees, you know, other environmental endpoints is what we call them. And so that combination of toxicity and exposure gives you risk. And what these models do is essentially quantify risk of a pesticide program.
What did you find relative to differences between Europe use of pesticide, which of course is getting more and more restrictive all the time, and pesticide use in the States from the data you were able to get?
Yeah, this was one of the biggest questions that I had, because especially working at GEO, I would talk to superintendents around Europe and they would say, oh, pesticide use is so much higher in the US than it is here. And while I wanted to trust them, there was basically no science on the matter. And so I thought that was an opportunity for my PhD work. And so we did the survey in the US and in Europe, collected pesticide use information, recorded all of that in the right formats, ran it through the pesticide risk indicator models as we were talking about. The results are exactly as the superintendents had said. Pesticide risk is much, much lower in Europe than it is in the US. Many factors lower. How much lower depends on what golf courses you're comparing and what models you're using, but it is a lot lower in Europe. And you might ask, like, why is that the case? And we looked at many different factors, but it, in our minds, it was pretty clearly one of the simplest possible causes, which is that simply in Europe, if you're in Norway, for example, there are only fewer than 10 active ingredients that you're allowed to use on a golf course. Whereas in the US, you know, we all know it's much higher than that.
When you tweezed out some of the data in the States with regard to pesticide use, I know you had a good cross-section of the country. You know, it's never as much as you'd like, but you were at least able to sort of visualize the data. When you're just looking at the States and pesticide use in the States, what were the significant trends that you observed?
Right. What we found was that pesticide use was actually not as regionally variable as what we thought. So we had five regions around the U.S., the Northeast where you are, Florida, East Texas, the Midwest, and part of the Northwest as well. And our original thinking was that, well, you know, the golf season is a lot longer down south than it is up north, say in Wisconsin, for example. But it turned out that pesticide risk on golf courses in all these different regions around the country was more or less the same. None of them were statistically different. And the reasons for that are, you know, there are a number of them, but I'll just give you one of them to start with, which is that at least on golf courses in Florida, most of the pesticide use and risk comes from greens. You know, greens are in Florida are applied with pesticides fairly regularly, but greens are a small part of a golf course. Whereas in Wisconsin, the greens are not treated to the same intensity. However, the fairways are treated at a relatively higher intensity in comparison to the courses down south. So even though the season is shorter in Wisconsin, the golfing season, that is, the fairways take up a lot of area. They're treated more intensely with pesticides, and therefore, at least the risk between East Texas, Florida, and Wisconsin was all pretty similar.
And it highlights one of the critical aspects that our work here in New York and your work there, the amount of land you treat, the size of the acreage that you treat. Of course, you could treat greens that's only 3 acres a lot, and then that's a lot of acreage over total. But when you're treating 20 to 30 acres of fairway rough, even 8 times, it'd be hard-pressed to spray greens that much. So obviously, if we think about sustainability, one of the things that's important is to, as I've understood your work, is to, you know, dial down the intensity of pesticide use on your largest acreage. And, you know, this is where Carl and I talk a lot about using models. Paul Koch, of course, at your alma mater, and the Rutgers folks talking about using the models for dollar spot to predict. So maybe you can be better when you're going to make those applications. So all those things are tied together, Michael, and they're generally wrapped up into a bow or a program that we call best management practices. So we really promoted BMPs, right? What did your work tell you about using models or moisture meters or all the soil testing, all the things that tell us, you know, these are best management practices? I mean, you're in the weeds measuring, you know, knowing what guys are using, predicting what they should be using. Does implementing best management practices as we've codified them inherently lead to sustainability from your perspective?
We would hope so. You know, that was one of my main questions, right? Is does implementing best management practices lead to better outcomes? And unfortunately, at least in the resource use department, the answer is no. Not at all.
Okay. So just so everybody's clear, implementing BMPs based on your work does not seem to lead to lower resource use.
It doesn't. Okay. It actually more often makes the problem worse than it makes the problem better.
Okay. All right. So let's leave it there for a minute, because I want to talk to you now about how you put that finding in perspective. How do you put the finding that, well, resource use is really high, even though they may be implementing all these BMPs? How can I say that's sustainable? But wait a minute, if BMPs are supposed to make me sustainable, how did you then bring efficiency into the conversation, knowing what you knew then?
Right. What we were trying to do was looking at how efficient golf courses were being based on these models that we're using. And then we're looking at how the uptake of their BMPs. And our original hope was that higher BMP uptake would lead to greater efficiency. And it turned out that that was just not the case. Most of the time, efficiency is not correlated at all to whether or not a BMP is being taken up or not. And there could be many, many reasons why this is. I think one reason is that BMPs are often taken up by higher end golf courses, mm-hmm. and higher end golf courses are often using more resources. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you have your local mom and pop golf course down the street, maybe not using a whole lot of water, but they're also not using handheld moisture probes. Mm-hmm. And if you go down to the country club that has much higher maintenance budget, they're applying more water and they're also using moisture probes. So yeah, the one BMP that worked for us was not fertilizing your roughs allows you to use less fertilizer. Not exactly a huge discovery there.
No.
But that is the one BMP that worked as advertised.
But what I thought was novel was that you started to bring in the rounds of golf. You know, a sustainability question is got the environmental component. It's obviously got the profitability component and it's got the social component, right? You looked at quote-unquote yield as rounds. That made it look a little different, didn't it? When you looked at high-intensity golf courses that were using resources, you also found in many cases, if they were putting a lot of people through, it made that eco-efficiency, as you described it, that particular value greater.
Absolutely, because what you're saying there is about the eco-efficiency work that we did, which is comparing the inputs and the outputs. Mm-hmm. You know, the inputs that we've been talking about, they're resources, but outputs are also important. And in golf, it's not entirely clear what those outputs are, as it is, for example, in agriculture, where you have this easily quantifiable yield that is very clearly your output. But in golf, the output is essentially an experience.
That's right.
Now, how are you going to think about that? And that was a really interesting question for us. And what we landed on was one easily quantifiable way of quantifying the degree to which a golf course provides recreational value, provides benefit to a community, is simply the number of rounds that are played. So, you know, let's say a golf course is using a lot of resource to maintain the course. Well, maybe they're also hosting a lot of rounds of golf. Mm-hmm. And so you can justify that resource use based on all of the experience that you're providing the community. Mm-hmm. So looking at the ratio of rounds to resource use or other outputs that we thought of, we also thought of like profit. How much money is this golf course making? Mm-hmm. Is another way of thinking about these resource management questions.
I'll just say, as I've seen this spoken about, and you know, we've covered 5 to 6 papers that you've written in just about 10 minutes. So thanks to everybody for keeping up here. But at the end of the day, what this did for me, Michael, is it shined a very interesting light on like operations like Troon. Right? Corporate golf manages a number of many, many high-end properties, has to put a lot of resources into that, but at the same time, really gets a lot of yield from it, both maybe in profit and in rounds of golf. And so you start to see the golf management company model where they're counting their dollars, unlike maybe a private club that's, in your case, as you said, valuing just the experience, not necessarily profit, because, you know, it's a service to the members that the course is there versus a profit center for an operation like Troon. So it really shined a light on balancing sustainability by understanding what the course is being used for, and then hopefully getting folks to start to think about, does the level of intensity of management match the demand for the people that are coming here and having this experience? And I can tell you, as golf started to boom in the last few years, this has been a more interesting question for the industry. And so listen, Michael, let's take another break and then we'll come back and we'll talk about a lot of cool carbon work that you have talked about and done and also been working on in Norway. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. I'm with Michael Becken, a research scientist in Norway. We'll be right back. Delivering your products accurately and with precision requires smart spray technology. The professional spray tech folks at Frost Spray Technology have the right equipment available now to meet your needs. Sustainable management requires efficient product applications to make your spray day a great day. Learn more about precision applications from Frost Spray Technologies at frostserve.com. That's Frost, S-E-R-V.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Frank Rossi here with Michael Becken, working in Norway. Michael, I saw you recently at the crop science meetings, and you've obviously been speaking at the International Turf Society. Your work has really resonated in many circles, and certainly in the scientific community. And when I saw you there, you were talking about carbon. And you were talking about carbon stocks and emissions and the importance of sort of quantifying how much carbon, you know, we're storing in golf courses. But before we get to that, and before you started your job and part of your career, you did a Fulbright scholarship studying in Norway. So let's take a minute and talk about that little bit of side hustle you did while you were pursuing this work we've been talking about. Talk about your Fulbright and the work you did at Norway, and then we'll get into sort of how you're carrying that work on now.
After I finished it in Doug's lab in 2022, I wanted to try to make it back to Europe. I'd lived in, of course, Scotland, as we talked about earlier, before going to Madison, and was also really curious. I had started to do some carbon work on golf courses in my PhD and doing a degree in geology in my undergrad. I've always been interested in the Earth system as a whole, not just golf courses, obviously. Golf has been tremendously important to me in my life, and I've studied it for a long time too. But I wanted the opportunity to step outside of the golf and the turf world, and so applied for a Fulbright to University of Oslo and was lucky enough to get accepted. And while at Oslo, I studied peatlands in Norway, so organic soils here in Norway. And many peatlands in Norway have been drained for agriculture, for forestry. And once the peatland soil is drained, it starts to release a lot of that carbon that's in the organic matter in the soil to the atmosphere. Mm. And so now about 10% of all of Norway's carbon emissions and about 5% of total anthropogenic carbon emissions are from drained peatland soils around the world.
Okay, let's just let that drop for a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about climate change and carbon emissions, right, we think about, you know, fossil fuels and things we're burning, right? That's pretty common, and we're going to get to that discussion over time. But what people don't understand is these peatlands store enormous amounts of carbon, and when they're drained, the carbon starts to get degraded by microorganisms. I'm assuming this is the process. And then that process respires off a whole bunch of carbon into the atmosphere that used to be stored in these peatlands.
That's right.
And that's a lot. 10% of all human emissions.
Of 5%. 5% of all human emissions. Yeah. 10% in Norway.
10% in Norway, 5% of emissions, which for an oil-rich country like Norway had to be quite shocking that they'd been doing this. Now, they've since stopped this behavior, yes?
That's the interest, you know, trying to restore a lot of peatlands in Norway. And so now that a lot of peatland restoration projects are underway here, the question becomes, does peatland restoration reduce carbon emissions? And that's exactly what I was studying in my Fulbright.
Okay, what do we know so far?
We know that it does reduce emissions, but it takes longer than you might expect. So often 30 to 50 years for a peatland that has been drained, is emitting a lot of carbon to the atmosphere. Once it's restored, it will take 30 to 50 years for that peatland to become carbon neutral and then maybe become a carbon sink again. A lot of peatlands in Norway are roughly 10,000 years old. They started forming after the last ice age, and they've been slowly accumulating carbon. And over all of that time have built up a huge carbon stock. But now that we've drained them, we're starting to release that back to the atmosphere. And then now that we're trying to restore them, we'll eventually, hopefully, make them carbon sinks again.
Okay, so we've got some terminology now to work from as we talk about carbon on golf courses. There's sources, there's sinks, right? Sources of carbon emissions, as we've mentioned, come from the burning of fossil fuels in the variety ways we do it. You get some greenhouse gas emissions from nitrogen fertilizer applications. So those are a number of your sources. And so let's talk a little bit about how the golf course can be a sink, right? I tried to play around with this back in 2009, you know, didn't hardly know what we were doing. So talk a little bit about how golf courses store carbon, which of course are very different than peatlands.
Yes. So golf courses are mineral soils as opposed to organic soils. So a lot of the soil is the mineral component, not just the organic matter component. But the basic process is pretty simple, right? You've got carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Plants are taking in that CO2 and through photosynthesis are producing carbon-based sugars that they are both using for their own metabolism, but also incorporating that carbon into their plant tissues as well. And then that turf grass is mowed. So some of that plant tissue is constantly dying and falling as litter to the soil surface. And through time and microbial activity, that dead plant tissue, at least some of it, is turned into soil organic matter. And soil organic matter is what we would call a carbon pool or a carbon stock. It's a place that carbon is stored in the Earth system. It's an important place that carbon is stored in the Earth system. So basically, that's how golf courses and turf grass surfaces take carbon from the atmosphere and store it in soils.
And just so we're clear, what you're saying is these grass systems build soils.
They do, absolutely. Yeah. You think of mollisols or prairie soils that have these really thick mollic epipedons, which are basically just really thick layers of built-up organic matter over hundreds to thousands of years. Grassland ecosystems are really good at storing carbon.
Okay, so why is it important, in your opinion, for us as a golf course industry to measure these stocks? And then we're going to talk about simple ways to do it. So let's start out with, is it important for the golf course industry to start measuring carbon stocks on golf courses? We're not going to get into space for time and all the different methods yet, but I want to talk a little bit about the importance of just knowing these values.
I think it is important because climate change is the biggest environmental problem on our hands, and all parts of society have a role and responsibility to play in trying to mitigate rising CO2 levels and the changes that that's causing in our climate. But in order to understand the net climate impact of golf courses, we need to quantify our carbon emissions. That's really important. How much carbon are we releasing to the atmosphere? I'd argue that's actually most important that we quantify carbon emissions and try to reduce those. But it's also important to quantify carbon sequestration, the amount of sequestration that is occurring on a golf course, the amount of carbon that is being taken from the atmosphere and stored in the soil. And if we can do both of those things, quantifying emissions and quantifying sequestration, then we can understand the net climate impact of our golf courses. And then in so doing, understand basically our position in trying to mitigate climate change.
Perfect. What role do the trees on a golf course play?
They definitely play a role. Trees, just the same as turf grass, are sequestering carbon as well. You know, the average golf course is somewhere between 20 to 40%, I guess, on average, non-turf grass surface. In my work, I've specifically looked at the turf grass surface, so emissions from turf grasses and sequestration by turf grasses. I think the non-golfing components of a golf course are often not managed to the same degree as the turf, so maybe we have a little bit less control over that. But certainly, forests are a huge store of carbon in the Earth system as well, and an important one. And so eventually, we'd like to look at carbon stocks on non-turf areas of the golf course as well.
Okay. Let's see if you and I can outline the method that I saw you describe at the crop science meetings, where you draw a transect down the edge of a fairway, where you can take samples on either side of that transect, and you want to do that on roughly three fairways, and you want to go to a certain depth, and you want to segment the sample. So if that's correct, let's review that again, you and me. Give me some details about what we tell a superintendent on how to begin to measure the carbon stocks on their golf course. Because the sooner you do it, in 5 years from now, you can see what can be happening. And that also gives us a great national database or international database to start predicting the real value of sequestration on golf courses when we can continue to get real data, not modeled data, over time. Let's talk about the method.
For sure. This is the main area of my work right now, which is trying to come up with a soil sampling protocol for golf courses to determine their carbon sequestration rate. And this has all been funded by the RNA and the Golf Course 2030 initiative. Mm-hmm. So working with them very closely. And the basics of this protocol are to take six holes around an 18-hole golf course and to take six sampling locations per hole. So that is three sampling locations in the fairway, three sampling locations in the rough, then two to three soil samples at each sampling location, which is just, you know, a 5 square meter area, so a small area. And that gives you somewhere between 70 to 100 samples per 18-hole golf course. We're recommending that you take those soils to 30 centimeters, which is an international standard for carbon stock measurements, that you segment those 30 centimeter depth cores into 10 centimeter increments, and that you're testing each increment for bulk density and the soil organic carbon content as well. And then hopefully you go out, you do this on your course, you wait 5 years and you do it again.
Okay. This is a great beginning of a baseline of understanding how to sample soils. When you're sampling for bulk density, it's a little bit different than when you're doing a standard sample. And this discussion is completely different from the OM246 and the USGA method that we're using on putting surfaces. So that's where we're testing organic matter potentially for different purposes. This is where we're actually trying to establish those carbon stocks so we can have a baseline for how golf courses are really benefiting the environment from this perspective. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time. What a joy. You and I could go for another hour if we really want to get into these epipedons. That was a new word. I hadn't heard that word before. Very excited to hear that epipedon word. Really excited to see you hopefully at the international meetings in Japan. Will we see you there?
I will be there. Absolutely. Talking about carbon.
Excellent. Until then, I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. Michael Becken, a research scientist at the Norwegian Institute for Bioeconomy. Thank you for joining us. Big thanks to Dr. Michael Becken. Frankly Speaking, part of the TurfNet family of podcasts, is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. Frankly Speaking is in its 11th season, and we thank our major sponsors, Frostbray Technologies, Dryject Services, and The Plant Food Company, for the support that makes us possible. Take a minute and explore what they have to offer. Frankly Speaking is produced at Rep Studios in downtown Ithaca, New York, by Nate Richardson, with artwork and music by Nicole and Tucker Rossi. Support from Peter McCormick, John Kiger, and John Reitman. I'm Frank Rossi. Thank you for joining me.